I think that companies are realizing that actually this isn't just about preempting regulation and trying to shape regulation, but that there's a crisis of trust, right? And you read all the studies out there and people calling it the tech lash. And I think there's a recognition that actually companies can't wait for governments to figure this out, that in terms of mitigating some of the ways in which these technologies might start to harm people, that it's actually in companies and tech company and Silicon Valley's interest to be proactively addressing those issues, and not just because regulators want them to, but because that's actually how we build trust with our users.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rana Sarkar, Consul General of Canada in Silicon Valley, and you're listening to Confluence. Each week, we dive deep into the issues shaping tech, diplomacy, and the economic recovery in disruptive times through the lens of Silicon Valley, Canada, and the world. This week, we're talking pro-human tech. How do we build humane technology and flip the script to create tech that plays off the better angels of our nature and design tech intentionally to use human cognition and behavior to make ourselves and our societies better? How does the work of tech diplomacy serve in reducing harms while also creating equitable and fair societies? And can governments, policymakers, and tech companies work together to achieve this? This is easily one of the biggest conversations in the tech world, led by activists like Tristan Harris at the Center for Humane Technology. Over the last 4 years, we started to unpack the ways that tech impacts us, how design determines use, and how economic incentives drive engagement and addiction, and what the behavioral and social fallout of all of this might be. We're living in it. And these are real-time experiments playing out on a planetary scale with democracy at stake. To help us understand how far we've come and how far we still need to go, I'm talking to Zvika Krieger. Zvika doesn't fit the stereotypes of the Valley. He started out in journalism as a foreign correspondent at The Atlantic, and then went on to become an editor and writer at The New Republic, before taking a position as a Middle East correspondent for Newsweek based in Egypt and Lebanon, and covering most of the Arab world. You may have also seen him as an analyst on CNN and NBC. Then he made an interesting pivot. He joined government as senior strategist in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Then critically, he was the U.S. State Department's first ever representative to Silicon Valley. When Davos broke out of the Alps and started an outpost in Silicon Valley, Zvika joined them, serving on the executive committee of the World Economic Forum, where he launched the centers of the Fourth Industrial Revolution in 13 countries, all from the spiritual and physical base right here in Silicon Valley. But recently, he's even made a bigger pivot. He's now the director of responsible innovation at Facebook, where he works with teams to help anticipate and mitigate harms through the product development lifecycle. In this moment of the reassertion of civic voice and sharp move to regulate big tech and its incentives, we can often overlook what's happening inside big tech's product creation box. Can intentional development be part of the solution? In addition to top-down and outside-in reform, can nudges, tools, and incentives and deliberation help engineers build better, pro-human products? Who's involved in what has, up until now, been a black box of design? And who should be involved? Companies are taking tentative steps. At Facebook, it's Zvika's job to figure it out. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to sit down with him.
Thank you so much for being with us today. I know it's a busy day. Thank you for taking the time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Where am I finding you today?
I am sitting in my living room in Berkeley, California.
So where did you grow up, Zvika?
I grew up in Los Angeles, and so I'm a California boy, born and bred, and after about a 15-20 year hiatus, came back to my humble roots, though I do feel like sometimes Northern California is a different country than Southern California. I started my first day of Facebook in the first week of March of 2020. And so I was in the last class of in-person new hire orientation at Facebook. So I had just enough time to find my desk and fill up my backpack with free snacks and then go home to lockdown for the past year.
I just wanted to ask you about the arc of your career, because you seem to have been at the site of a lot of action over the last 15 years. From journalism and obviously the Middle East during a very interesting period, and helping big organizations like the Department of Defense and the State Department start to pivot around big issues like climate change and the impact of new technologies. And then going on to the World Economic Forum, which is an extraordinary forum for bringing together industry and governments for innovative solutions, and then joining Facebook. So I just wanted to get your sense of what motivated you along those decision paths along the way.
Well, thanks for the opportunity to reflect on a long and certainly eclectic or eccentric career path that I've had, though I do think in retrospect, I can see how each step along the way informed the next. And I think particularly when dealing with a lot of these new and unprecedented challenges, you need to weave together a wide range of experiences. And so I spent most of my early career as a journalist. I'm a sort of child of 9/11, you might say. I was in undergrad when 9/11 happened. And so certainly in that time where there was a lot of fascination and attention being paid to the Middle East. And so studied Arabic as an undergrad, did study abroad there, spent my summers in the region, and also was very into journalism and writing. And so it was a sort of natural first step for my career. Got a great break early in my career as a early 20-something to go and be a Middle East correspondent for Newsweek. And so packed up my bag and went there in the mid-2000s, which was a fascinating time to be there. Sort of pre-Arab Spring, got to see a lot of the early roots of democracy movements fomenting there right at the heat of the Iraq War. So got to do a couple of embeds in Iraq and see that formative experience up close. But also got to see a region that was really in transition and the clash of modernity and tradition and how technology in particular was bringing people new perspectives. I got to see it firsthand in the early, early days of social media that it was very easy for governments to keep people within a limited set of liberties and a limited set of opportunities when their access to information was low. But as people started to see what was happening around the world and what a better life, help imagine what a better life could look like, it really did plant the seeds for a lot of the transformation that we saw in the region subsequently. And so it was an amazing experience. But after smoking one too many cigarettes and being in one too many bomb explosions, I finally decided it was time to come back to America. And so lived in DC for a couple years, returned to another battleground. And in that I came back in 2008 to cover the elections and, you know, was there during the Democratic primaries with this little known senator from Illinois who was just starting to get traction, and also the sort of general election. So it was a fascinating time to be in Washington, D.C. Started writing about, you know, domestic politics, domestic extremism, but also foreign policy with a sort of Washington perspective. So worked for a number of publications, as you mentioned, in the D.C. area, and got the opportunity to go into government, got a call. And it was never something that I really intended to do. I always saw government as a place of frustrating bureaucracy and sort of mind-numbing paper pushers and the place where good ideas went to die. And so never really, despite being in DC for 8 years and, you know, being in the sort of belly of the beast, was never really tempted to go into government. But, you know, at a certain point, you know, the bug bites you and there's only so long you can stand on the sidelines, and that it's easy to critique and analyze. But the hard part is really, all right, you know, big talk, but how would you solve these issues if you were in the seat? And so particularly the opportunity to work for Ash Carter, who was the deputy secretary at the time and then became the Secretary of Defense, particularly felt like a unique opportunity. And if there's any sort of through line in my career, it's the opportunity to try new things and get new experiences and push myself.
And what was that like, being new to government and working on innovation initiatives within the Department of Defense and then eventually at State? How were you received? How did it work internally?
You know, when I was applying for the job or sort of in conversations with them, they were very upfront with me and they said, you know, you're the only candidate on our list who has no experience working in government, has never served in the military, and doesn't even really have experience with defense policy. And so you were sort of our, you know, diversity pick kind of wild card candidate at the bottom of the list. But as we started thinking more about this job and thinking about how we wanted someone to think a little bit more creatively and strategically, your outsider status went from a liability to an asset. And so I think that in some ways for me felt like a mandate to come in and to not pretend that I was an expert in defense policy or any of the issues that we were working on, but to bring that outsider's perspective. And, you know, I was the one in every meeting who would raise my hand and ask what felt like the obvious question, but it was sort of from the mouth of babes, kind of, you know, the question that was on everyone's mind, but nobody wanted to ask. And so I think it became an asset, and also my journalism background, which is that I approach everything with curiosity. And so it was really about going around, listening, talking to people, gathering multiple perspectives, bringing in diverse perspectives and trying to synthesize them. And so I definitely played up my outsider status. I think the other thing that really helped me is that I never saw myself as a career government bureaucrat. And, you know, I was fine. I actually imagined that I would spend a year, maybe two at most, in government and then go back to journalism because I loved being a journalist. And so I wasn't worried about my career. I wasn't worried about offending people. I wasn't worried about following the rules. I was really focused on driving impact and really pushing forward new ideas and trying to counter the status quo in many ways. And I think ironically, that's what made me successful in government, is that I wasn't playing it safe. I would be happy to sort of show up at work one day and get fired. Like, that would have been success for me. But the irony is that never happened.
I think that's a theme that a lot of folks listening and other folks are thinking about right now. And it's that, how do we bring this different pace into our bureaucracies and our companies at a time when systems around us are changing significantly? Just on your government experience, what are the couple of things that you're most proud of from that experience? And what did you learn there? Obviously, you ended up back out here as the first member of the State Department just prior to the change in government. How did that come about?
In terms of like what I'm most proud of and what I learned the most, one of the things is that the military is some of the best people that I've come across at thinking about the future, right? The whole idea about sort of the whole discipline of scenario planning and strategic foresight, it really originated in the military, what one might argue. And there's whole teams that are devoted to war gaming and future foresight planning. And that's where I got to cut my teeth on a lot of those disciplines. And, you know, particularly I spent a lot of time looking at emerging technologies and what might the impacts of emerging technologies be on our defense strategy. And so a lot of the muscles that I first learned in working with the military have very much served me as I've come out to Silicon Valley and taken on a number of roles where thinking about the future is really core to what I'm trying to accomplish. In terms of your second question, you know, how did I get out to Silicon Valley? And so, you know, eventually I made the move over to the State Department, which, you know, in some ways felt more naturally aligned to my sensibilities and being a big fan of diplomacy and public engagement. And I was running an innovation lab there, which was essentially a new office that was devoted to really pushing creative solutions and trying to push through conventional wisdom around a lot of big policy issues. And at the time, Tony Blinken was really the driver behind this idea, you know, recognizing that almost every foreign policy issue that we were confronted with at the time, and this was like 2014, 2015, 2016, you know, increasingly everyone had a technology sector component to it, whether as technology as part of the problem or technology as part of the solution, or perhaps both. And increasingly the big technology companies, particularly based in Silicon Valley, were having an outsized impact on almost every foreign policy issue. And I might argue that having more of an impact than many governments around the world. And even while the State Department had an embassy in almost every capital in the world, we didn't really have anyone whose job it was to engage with the technology companies out here. And so Deputy Secretary Blinken at the time, now Secretary Blinken, was sort of noticing that, thought that we needed a more robust way of engaging. His team reached out to me and said, hey, you run the innovation lab. You've got some tech experience. When I worked with Ash Carter at the Defense Department, I had helped think through how the Defense Department can engage with Silicon Valley. And so I had some experience there. And they said, hey, would you want to move out there and just, you know, pilot this and see what it would be like to have a State Department representative to Silicon Valley. And so, you know, wanting to return to my California roots and a little bit better weather, I was glad to make the trip back here.
And how have you seen the evolution of technology diplomacy here in Silicon Valley? And maybe you could describe that a bit, because you certainly took that on through your role at World Economic Forum as well. And of course, since you've been at Facebook now.
I think that the technology is racing ahead and developing and progressing and evolving much faster than the policy environment, right? And I think that it's just a fact of life that policy development process, it's slow, it's deliberative, it's inclusive. And that's by design, right? We don't want to just have, you know, policies being written on the spur of the moment. But because of that, policy is always lagging. I mean, technology is fast. It's constantly changing. And so I think that we are seeing a gap between what's out there in the world in terms of technology products and, you know, government sort of struggling to keep up with that pace of change. And I think what we're seeing is that either one, you're seeing outdated policies that are being applied to new technologies, so they're not fit for purpose, or you're seeing policy vacuums where technologies are allowed to just run sort of unchecked out in the world because there's no policies that it's taking too long for policies to be made around them. Or you're seeing reactive policymaking, right? Where governments are coming out with just hastily reacting to the sort of crisis du jour or whatever headline about big tech they're seeing and not sort of thoughtfully considering the ways in which policies can shape technology. And so all three of those situations are not ideal. And so I think this trend where governments are starting to build deeper relationships with the tech sector, I think, is a really positive development.
What I would say is that I've been here since 2017. I've seen at least three different iterations of the relationship between governance and the tech community out here. In the first instance, it was, you know, the tail end, perhaps, of we should trust them, tech can do no wrong. Governments essentially discovering technology is not this adjunct thing that was to be dealt with in the cyber policy area. So there was a lot of catch up in that first instance. From discovery, we went from lane formation very quickly, which was clearly, you know, every conversation when I first arrived here would go from a conversation about privacy to turn about data security to turn into security level conversations. And I'd say that the third part is where we're potentially are right now, which is where the technology companies are developing their own literacy in the way that governments act. And so now both sides are developing a little bit more literacy in what each other is doing. And also on the other side, from regulators, we're seeing a sort of a more calibrated understanding of how to address technology companies.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is an incredibly accurate description. And I definitely have vivid memories of that first phase of what you call the discovery phase. And it was certainly a kind of bright-eyed, almost tech utopianist kind of attitude. When I was in that role at the State Department, almost every day I would get an email saying, you know, hey, we've got this foreign policy issue or this humanitarian issue. Get Silicon Valley to help. You know, like, what can Silicon Valley do? And it was almost like every problem we had, the solution was Silicon Valley. And so there were certainly ways in which Silicon Valley could help the tech companies out here, but it was just this sort of, you know, sense of this magic fairy dust that existed out near the Golden Gate Bridge somewhere. But there wasn't like a deep understanding of, A, like, there are lots of different companies out here who do lots of different things and also have lots of different interests. And they're also private sector companies. And, you know, some of them have, you know, social impact arms, or, you know, some are mission driven to lesser and greater extents. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, how do you align incentives so that the private sector and the public sector are aligned in what they're trying to accomplish? Maybe the encryption debate that was happening around that time was really the transition between sort of phase one and phase two, where there was this recognition of like, oh, like, Silicon Valley and government aren't always going to be best friends. And there will be areas in which tech companies and government might disagree. Now, you know, not only are we seeing tech companies getting savvier about government, and it represents a real maturity here in Silicon Valley, where I think there was an early stage of who cares about government, right? And let's move fast and break things and let's get things out into the world and government will catch up behind us. And, you know, of course, Facebook never did that. But probably the most obvious example is what we saw with like the car sharing companies and ride sharing, where there was no laws and regulations. And their strategy was like, let's just get out on the street. Let's get our cars out there. Let's get our apps. You know, it's taking way too long for governments to figure out how they want to regulate this. And let's build a consumer and citizen sort of support base for this so that if and when regulations do come, there's already a clear sense of what the value of this is. And so, you know, I think that's probably the clearest manifestation of this kind of who cares about government attitude, but actually policy could make or break our core business models. And so we need to build sophisticated relationships with governments and with policymakers. But that's kind of the third phase that you outlined, which I think is definitely a thing. But I might add a fourth phase, which is I think that companies are realizing that actually this isn't just about preempting regulation and trying to shape regulation, but that there's a crisis of trust, right? And you read all the studies out there and you know, people calling it the tech lash. And I think there's a recognition that actually companies can't wait for governments to figure this out, that in terms of mitigating some of the ways in which these technologies might start to harm people, that it's actually in companies and tech company and Silicon Valley's interest to be proactively addressing those issues, and not just because regulators want them to, but because that's actually how we build trust with our users. And even when policy does come, I think you're increasingly seeing companies, and I would put Facebook in this category, who see policy as the floor, not the ceiling for a lot of these issues.
I wanted to just unpack the kind of evolution of thinking within large organizations like Facebook around this issue of putting harms and the mitigation of harms as central to product development, central to innovation, and in some ways existential to the sustainability of the organization itself. And so how did you see the evolution since you've been there of this conversation?
I think the conversation really started in the 7, 8, 9 years ago, really from the security perspective. I think that was kind of like the first big topic when it came to kind of the potential harms of technology products. And that's when you saw like a big investment in companies around cybersecurity. And, you know, we started getting into the world of data breaches and hackers and making sure that our products are safe. And it's interesting because privacy, you know, only emerged later as kind of a separate issue. Like privacy was initially seen as like a subset of safety and security, and that it was about protecting the data. And of course, some of the major kind of data breach and hacking scandals like really helped bring those issues to the fore. And so I think that we've gone from like safety to privacy, and privacy is still a top issue, but I think that we've come to a place where a lot of these companies have built infrastructures around privacy and the resources to prioritize it. And then I think kind of the next phase is what we at Facebook call integrity, what some other companies call trust and safety, which is looking at, you know, a lot of these bad behaviors on the platforms and how do we sort of root out toxic actors and malicious actors on the platform. And, you know, that's when we get to things like bullying and harassment and hate speech and even incitement to violence and things like that on our platforms. Like that is sort of a whole different brand of issues than privacy. And I think a lot over the past few years in particular, and we also have like an entire integrity organization that focuses on these issues with, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of people. So I think you see a lot of the companies taking that seriously. And in recent years in particular, you know, you're seeing concrete manifestations of that around like misinformation, polarization, or, you know, issues around elections and civic engagement, vaccine misinformation. That is certainly, I would say, top of mind for a lot of companies these days.
In contrast to the creation of technology that amplifies our worst human instincts, I'm seeing this idea of pro-human technology. I wonder if you could speak about that.
As you look at that evolution from like safety to privacy to integrity and now to kind of like civic discourse, I think that's kind of like the next phase that we're in when we're talking about responsible innovation in technology. I think that the hot topic right now is around issues of bias, discrimination, fairness, equity, and how thinking on conventional wisdom on these issues is shifting so quickly as awareness is changing. And so I think that my team, when we work with product teams, I would say that like in terms of what teams are concerned about and what harms they want to mitigate, we see issues around bias and discrimination and fairness and equity as being one of the top issues. And I think particularly the shift in consciousness that I've seen over the past year is the shift from neutral being something that you aspire to neutral being something that actually inherently entrenches the status quo and entrenches the inequities that we've seen and that have built up in society over the past few decades, if not centuries. And so I definitely like that's a pretty major shift in consciousness. And I think we see it throughout the conversations across product teams at Facebook. What am I actually doing at Facebook? Basically, we're sort of deeply embedded in the product org. And so we're not part of the policy or the legal part of the organization, but we're sort of embedded with the folks who are developing products on a day in, day out basis. And our job is to work with those teams to help them, first of all, anticipate the ways in which their products might potentially harm people, and then to help them mitigate those risks. And obviously, there are a lot of teams at Facebook who are working on dimensions of that. But what is sort of unique about our team is that, first of all, we tend to engage very early with product teams, right? So this isn't about, hey, like we have this product, we've prototyped it, we've alpha and beta tested it, and you know we're getting ready to launch. What do you think? But this is more like, hey, we're conceiving of these new products and these new features. How could this go wrong? Right? Who could this potentially harm? What might be the unintended consequences? And I think that what I've learned over the past year is that, first of all, there's like a very natural bias that anyone who's developing anything, it's not unique to the technology sector. Like if you're developing a new product, you're just inherently going to be biased at thinking about the ways in which your product is going to help people. Nobody jumps out of bed every morning, gets excited to go to work, thinking about all the ways in which the thing you're spending countless hours working on might harm people. It's just a natural human bias. And so you need folks who can help you think about what the dark side might be of a product that also has a lot of great benefits to society. But also you need folks to help you think about a very broad range of harms. Some people are really think about privacy. You know, some people are really focused on like mental health and like screen addiction and dopamine economy and those issues. Some people really care about child safety, and some people are really care about the climate. And so they just are always thinking about environmental impact. And all of those things are important, but like most people don't inherently think about all of them and more. And so my team sort of works with product teams to think broadly across a really wide spectrum of harms, and then to think about how they might mitigate those harms early in the development process as they're sort of still conceiving of how these products might look.
We often see incentives need to be better aligned to getting the aggregate outcome of harms not being done. Where do you think we are on the broader incentive alignment, meaning the business model incentive, and how is that evolving within organizations like Facebook, but within other organizations as well?
Yeah, I think that there is a rising consciousness, both at the sort of working level and at the leadership level at Facebook and beyond. And I wouldn't say rising consciousness, it is front and center that the impacts of our products on society are the existential risk for this company, right? And that it's not about, you know, getting more users and driving more revenue, but that the ways in which our products might be sort of misused to harm democracy and to harm people's sort of well-being, like this is what's actually going to undermine the core mission of our company. And again, it's not like, oh, the regulators and the policymakers are forcing us to do this. I would say there was a time over the past few years where there was a significant gap between consumer awareness of how their data is being used or the impact of these technologies on them and like what was actually happening. And so companies had a choice of like, okay, well, our customers or our users like don't really realize these things. And so we could actually just kind of barrel forward without paying much attention to these issues. I don't think Facebook did that. And I think that a number of other companies didn't do that, but there's at least the option of doing that. But I think in the past year, that awareness gap has closed. And I think users are realizing hey, this is the data that's being collected. Here's how the data could and is being used. This is how these platforms are impacting kind of civic discourse and polarization. And I think that people are being more empowered to make decisions around those. And so companies are feeling the imperative to respond, right? Like, we want to create a platform that is providing value to our users and is where our users want to be. And so I don't think it's like a doing the right thing. It's like creating the kind of platform that our users want to be on.
At a global level, we're all, I think, at this next juncture. A number of global forums have emerged. Countries have evolved a kind of a political leadership and a bureaucratic leadership that's looking to do something, and often in coordination. So we're working in coordination with our colleagues here in the United States and Britain and Australia, New Zealand, and France, and other countries to work in a more coordinated fashion around these issues. So we have a global set of rules, or at least rules of many democratic countries on these issues. Clearly, there's going to be legislation in a number of these countries that is going to be slightly pointed. It's going to make the operating environment for tech platforms and tech companies more generally more complicated. Where do you see the US leadership in this? And where do you see countries like Canada playing a role in coming to a new set of global rules and standards to get us into that fourth phase that we discussed?
So I think that like one of the biggest risks to the innovation economy that we're seeing right now is, you know, what some folks are calling the balkanization of the internet, or the rise of multiple internets around the world. And part of that is due to what folks call techno-nationalism and what I might describe as sort of wrong-headed kind of ideas around data localization and thinking about data as kind of like a third industrial revolution asset that needs to be like hoarded and centralized within borders. And so I think that you've kind of got a range of reasons. And then you've got authoritarian governments who are looking to control the flow of information in and out of their country. And so for lots of different reasons, you're seeing kind of the balkanization or fragmentation of the internet. And I think that, that's bad for a number of reasons. Like, number one is that part of the success of what has allowed innovation to spring around the world is the ability for data to sort of freely flow across borders. And I think that we're going to undermine a lot of the ability to innovate at scale. But frankly, the people who are going to suffer the most from the balkanization of the internet are the people in the global south or in countries that don't have as robust innovation ecosystems and don't have this sort of data sets and the infrastructure to build a lot of this within their own borders. And so, of course, we need to make sure that the benefits of these technologies accrue equally and evenly to folks from across economies. And it's not just like American or Western companies, or for that matter, Chinese companies that are just kind of extracting data from these other jurisdictions and not bringing value back. But I do think that the fragmentation of the internet is like one of the more worrisome trends that I'm personally seeing. And I think that the US and Canada and a lot of the sort of G7 countries have a role to play in bringing a unified approach to this in a way that's not just, it doesn't have to be like a kind of free for all open borders data regulatory environment. And I do think that there are certainly ways in which that hasn't been fit for purpose over the past few years, but it doesn't mean we have to go to the other extreme where every government has their own fenced in internet with their own unique regulations.
And where do you get involved?
Because like responsible innovation is such a like multi-dimensional challenge, we have a really multi-dimensional approach where we work both in hands-on with product teams. So we sort of sit side by side with them, whether that's in office hours where teams can bring us kind of their ideas or their design mockups or their wireframes, and we can give them guidance. We do workshops where we do these kind of, you know, drawing, going back to my scenario planning background at the, you know, the Pentagon years ago, like walk them through different foresight scenarios to think about, you know, all the different ways in which the products might create harms. We do deep dives where we'll embed with product teams for like a couple months and work side by side with them to do this anticipation and mitigation work. But then also we bring in outside voices. And I think this is really key, and something that I've learned is like really key to helping broaden the aperture for product teams is that, I mean, it's no secret that Silicon Valley has a diversity problem, right? And it's like mostly white men and mostly Americans. And so given the diversity of users that we are designing for, we need to bring in a diversity of perspectives to the table. And so we bring in not only academics and critics and provocateurs who can like push people outside of their normal way of thinking, but also the voices of marginalized and vulnerable and underrepresented populations, both here in the US and globally. And so that's another way that we work with product teams, is sort of exposing them to these external voices. But then it's also about education and shifting mindsets and skill sets. And so we have trainings for all new hires at Facebook in every sort of key product role for our product managers, our engineers, our data scientists, our product designers, our UX researchers, to help them develop the mindsets and the skill sets they need to do this work themselves, as well as ongoing training for folks around the company. Before I came to Facebook, I really thought that most of my debates and discussions and challenges with product teams would be, you know, where there was a product team that really wanted to launch a new feature out or a new product out into the world that would, you know, drive user growth, you know, drive retention and more daily active users, drive more revenue for the company. And that my team would identify or work with the team to identify ways in which the product might harm people. And there would be this tension, like, do we put out this product that a lot of people are going to use that would drive growth, but it might harm people? And I thought that would be the trade-off in most of the work we were doing as product teams. But I've been pleasantly surprised, and I feel like I'm still new enough to Facebook. I've been there for a year that I haven't drank in the Kool-Aid. I have some level of objectivity, but I've been pleasantly surprised by, first of all, that almost all of the discussions we've had are trade-offs between values. It's not good versus bad. One of the common conflicts we see is between safety and privacy, right? And that the more privacy you give people, the more that nefarious activities like violent extremist groups or human trafficking or bullying or child protection issues, like the more of that goes underground, right? Because you're giving people privacy, so we don't have access. Law enforcement doesn't have access. And so it's harder to catch a lot of that bad behavior. And so you have a trade-off between privacy and safety. Or another trade-off that we see a lot is between well-being and autonomy, right? Where there are certain behaviors that we see on our platform that when sort of abused could have negative impacts on people's mental health. And so should we just go out and ban those behaviors? Or is there, you know, is that a paternalistic way of treating our users, and they should have the autonomy to make decisions about how they use products? And so there's not a right or wrong answer there, but it's about how do you navigate those trade-offs and how do you find the win-win? And in the issues where it's a sort of black and white growth versus potential harm, I've been pretty impressed in the vast majority of situations that it's not even a discussion. It's like, oh, if this is gonna harm people, like we should not do it. Right. And so I think there's like maybe a stereotype that people had, maybe even I had, you know, being outside these tech companies, of like, they're people who just don't care about harming their users. And that has not at all been my experience in the company.
Thank you very much, Zeka Krieger, for your time.
Thank you for having me on the show. It's always a great opportunity to take a step back and reflect on broader themes and issues, and grateful to you for all your work on this as well.
I'm so happy to have had the chance to connect with Zeka. I admire his openness and the work that he's been putting in at all angles to tackle the topics that are quickly becoming the biggest issues our society faces today. Here in Silicon Valley, we've been seeing this a lot, where policy and regulation meet the culture around product development. We're in the middle of those conversations, and often they have a direct impact on influencing government policy and product development around the globe. Canada will do the work to understand and help steer us through this revolutionary landscape, with the emphasis of always promoting human rights and reducing harms, and creating economic opportunity in this next economy. Thank you for listening to Confluence. We hope you're able to walk away from today's episode with some new perspectives. If you want to learn more about the world of responsible innovation, humane technology, and ethical development, we've included some resources in the show notes. Confluence is produced by the Consulate General of Canada in San Francisco in collaboration with Edit Audio. Special thanks to Zeka for being my guest, Production thanks to Wade Wallerstein, Kate Walter, Yi Bulye, Steph Colburn, Sophie Shin, and Ali Sirwa. I'm Rana, and thank you for listening, and see you next episode.